carried on motivation. Everything we see with our senses, we think is completely real, out there, existing from its own side. All the thoughts that we think that we believe that everything that we think is true. So we're completely convinced that our senses are telling us the truth and that the objects of our thoughts exist in the way our thoughts think they do. And we even think that we are the person that we think we are. That there's this real me who is such and such a person with this and that qualities and such life experiences and these likes and dislikes and opinions and how I'm right and how I'm wrong, and completely believe that we're exactly like we think we are. And yet all we need to do is ask questions, do things really exist in the way that they appear to me? And to begin investigating that. And we begin to see that most of what appears to us, what we believe in, is hallucination. So we look at things that are caused, that exist simply because the causes and conditions exist, and instead we see them as fixed and permanent and real. Things that are simply an accumulation of parts, we see as being a totally separate, independent object. Things that exist because they've been merely labeled and conceived, we think are totally existent from their own side as they appear to us. And so because of all this misperception and wrong conception, there's no wonder that we're confused. No wonder that we experience pain. Yet with our wisdom, when we start to question these things and release the tight grasping, and something changes. Not in the external objects, although it may appear that they change, but it's actually in how we're perceiving them. And so more peace comes to the mind because we're not fighting with the world so much. We're not misperceiving it and dividing it into camps of I like and I don't like. So it's a first step to training our mind so that we can get to this wisdom. We want to keep ethical discipline because ethics calms the mind, makes it more receptive to concentration and therefore wisdom. And also because in keeping our ethical discipline, one way to keep it is to begin to question how we perceive things. And so we can develop our wisdom through having the restraints that ethical discipline provides us. And then working with our mind to live within the precepts and using our wisdom, developing our wisdom in order to do so. So let's remember that we're doing this whole process not only to free ourselves, but for all limitless living beings who are just like us, suffering and wanting happiness, and who have been continually kind to us. And so aspire for the highest enlightenment for that purpose. So when we're trying to hold precepts, the precepts are like a fence. You know, we've voluntarily decided that we don't want to get involved in certain activities. And so we've chosen to take the precepts as a way of protecting ourselves from those activities. But then, because the mind has all this confusion in it and misperception in it, sometimes, you know, the unwise side of our mind comes back up. Only sometimes, not often. Roars its head and says, wait a minute, this is reality. What I'm perceiving is reality. And, you know, and that's why a couple of days ago when we had the discussion group about what are our non-negotiables and what's the difference between a want and a need, and our mind begins to say, but I need this. I absolutely, positively need it, and I cannot live without. You ever felt that way?
No, never.
And then this incredible civil war starts inside, doesn't it? You know, I need this. I want this. And even if you don't have precepts, you know, it's, but the world won't give it to me. You know, it's like, I want this, I need it, and how come I don't have it, and the world isn't giving it to me? And then when you have precepts, it's, oh, but this precept won't let me do it, and I need this, you know. And then you turn your mind on the precepts and see the precepts is the source of the problem. You know, the precepts have nothing to do with the problem, okay? The problem is one that's completely created by our own wrong conception mind. And what the precept is doing is just waving the flag saying, hey, you have some wrong conception mind going on there. Do you remember that, you know, you investigated this and you saw some wisdom in these precepts and you were really clear at that time. Do you remember? You know, the precept just kind of waves that flag, and part of us says, well, I was just totally confused then because I really need this. I can't live without it. And then we go on our whole story again, don't we? You know? And we have this incredibly, you know, solid story. Yeah? And so many reasons, so much logic. I mean, you'd think you would have thought we would have studied debate for 20 years and be a geshe by now. But all the logical reasons about how, you know, this thing that I need is absolutely positively exists in the way I perceive it, and how I've got to have it, and this need, this want is absolutely real, and there's nothing can be done about it, and I'm going to die if I don't have it. And we have this whole internal lawyer, you know, arguing the case. And of course, you know, we go along with it. But for a while, we're there in civil war. And so before we let the prosecutor win, we should really, send out the detectives and really check up on the prosecutor. See if this lawyer who's making the case is really on the up and up or not. And when we do, when we just start to question, you know. And I think it's very helpful for our mind to just ask ourselves questions, you know, instead of making statements, you know. Like, this doesn't exist the way it is, just get over it. I don't personally find that very helpful when I talk to myself that way. But to say, does this really exist the way it appears to me? And, you know, the way I think things will be if I get this, is this really the way they're going to be? You know, or this situation that I'm totally bummed out about and in so much pain, does it really exist the way it appears to me? No. And to just ask those kinds of questions. Okay? And so, of course, emptiness is the ultimate solution. But sometimes that's hard to contemplate at that time. So sometimes it's easy to start out with some of the other things. Yeah? And to just ask ourselves questions, you know. The mind says, oh, I absolutely need this chocolate ice cream. Completely I need it. And then you just say, well, what's the worst case scenario if you don't have it? Okay. And so the mind says, oh, I will be suffering all afternoon. And then you say, oh, is that really an unbearable, horrible suffering? You know, all afternoon because no chocolate ice cream? What about the kids in Iraq? You know? And so, you know, you just kind of put questions to yourself and begin to check it out. Or, you know, oh, this chocolate ice cream, it's going to definitely make me happy. What? You mean it has molecules of happiness inside of it? Where are those molecules of happiness? Yeah, you start, you know, put the chocolate ice cream out there and it starts melting. And you know how when it melts, it separates a little bit. It doesn't look creamy. It gets kind of this certain, you know, stuff, like little grain-looking things. It kind of melts, and then the marshmallows pop out. You remember that you don't really like marshmallows anyway. and the nuts pop out, and you remember how sometimes when you eat the nuts, your mouth feels kind of dry afterwards. And you start going, well, where's the happiness inside of this? You know, and if I left it out all night and I came back in the morning, is it still going to look like it has happiness in it? You know, and then, well, no, maybe it doesn't have happiness in it. Okay. So you start to question how the things appear to us. I use chocolate ice cream as an example. You can use whatever your neurosis of the day happens to be. Whatever the mind's clinging on to that day. You know, my lover, my parent, my child, my, you know, cat. Whatever it is. You know, and just question. And especially if it's another living being that we're attached to. I find, you know, that's much easier in one way to dispel the attachment. Because just, I mean, remember that diagram, that thing from the science exhibit in Cleveland. Just peel off their skin. That's all, you know. Just mentally remove their skin and ask yourself if you were perceiving them accurately. Yeah? If you do it, it works, you know. The thing is, we don't like this meditation of peeling off the skin because, yuck. But that's precisely the point, isn't it? Yeah? And even if it's somebody that you're angry with, I find, you know, if I peel off the skin, then it's like, oh, this is a suffering sentient being. Who's there to be angry at? You know, it's this mind stuck inside this disgusting, filthy body. How can I be angry at somebody? And if it's, you know, a person you have a lot of desire for, it's like, I don't really want to hug about the skin. Thank you very much. You know? Do you?
No.
Yeah? You know, the bones and the sinews and the nerves and it's, you know, blood and lymph and intestines and kidneys. And, you know, I don't really feel like hugging and kissing that. Yuck. So if the mind just gets more balanced, you know, we begin to see the other person for more, you know, for more as what they really are. So whether it was somebody we hated or somebody we're attached to, I mean, bottom line is they're a suffering sentient being. They're a consciousness trapped in a body under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment, experiencing the result of karma. What's there to be attached to? What's there to hate? You know, it just kind of all of our, whatever our wrong conception of the day that we were projecting, just, it just goes away. You know, and there's just some compassion for this living being that you realize is just something that is labeled in dependence upon a consciousness, you know, affiliated with a certain aggregation of molecules. And that's it. You know, they're nothing more than that. Okay, so it becomes a way to generate wisdom and compassion. And then, you know, all these incredible projections that we've put on people that we suffer so much because of. Or, you know, projections that we've put on any object or anything, you know, they begin to subside. Okay. Sometimes we have some resistance to meditating in this way because, you know, one part of our mind says attachment, yeah, you know, yeah, attachment is one part of the three poisonous minds. Yeah, it's an obstacle for liberation. Yeah, we need to get rid of attachment. And then the other part of our mind says, oh, but attachment makes me so happy. I need attachment. I need my objects of attachment. If I don't have them, who am I going to be? What am I going to do? How am I ever going to be happy? Yeah? And we really believe that thought. We totally believe that thought. You know? Who am I going to be without this person? What am I going to do if I can't have this object? Now, how will I ever be happy if I don't have these people who love me and who tell me I'm wonderful and I don't have all my friends and all the appreciation and the reputation? How will I ever be happy? Impossible. And we just believe those thoughts. And so when we believe those thoughts, then we don't apply the antidotes. We have them all written down. And it doesn't matter whether your teachers, you know, type them out and reproduce them for you and, you know, or whether you wrote them in your own notebook. You have all of them, but you don't take them out and apply them at that moment because the mind is so convinced that what's appearing to it is true. Yeah. And we're so afraid that if we loosen the attachment, we're going to suffer. Yeah, we don't really see attachment as the cause of suffering. Some part of us still thinks attachment's the cause of happiness. And it takes a long, long time, like eons, folks, you know. This is not going to be next Wednesday or, you know, next year or something like that, unless you've already done eons in the past of training the mind. So it really takes, you know, a lot of effort, you know, continuity and persistence of just questioning our thoughts, you know, and guiding our mind back to reality. And sometimes, you know, there's so much resistance in our mind we don't apply the antidote and we get really stuck for a while. And at a certain point, if we're fortunate, we are in so much pain that all of a sudden we remember we should try and apply the Dharma. You know? If we're not lucky, then we just follow the attachment. But at some point, you know, if we're really lucky, we're in so much pain over the attachment or the jealousy or the anger, whatever it is, that we decide, ah, maybe I need to try and practice. And so then we, you know, pull out the notebook and, oh yeah, I remember that technique. I thought that was a pretty cool technique, but I never did it. Maybe I need to do it. Okay? So, you know, the whole point I'm trying to get at here, well, there's several different points, actually. You know, afflictions cause suffering. That's one point. Second, we don't always realize afflictions cause suffering. Sometimes we buy into them and we think they're right. Third, we don't realize that afflictions are out of touch with reality. Okay? And fourth, you know, we need to apply the antidote sooner rather than later. And fifth, that it actually, when we do, then it's possible to restabilize the mind and come back to some balance and have some letting go and some peace in the mind. Yeah. And how do precepts fit in this? How does monastic life fit in this? Is monastic life, you know, we've chosen not to do certain activities because we've had wisdom in our mind that has said, I don't want to do these activities. So when the attachment or the anger, whatever, comes up, the rebelliousness, when it comes up, you know, if we're able to identify that attitude as the cause of suffering and train ourselves in the antidotes, then, you know, we're able to develop wisdom. And so the precepts, you know, by making that fence around us that protects us from negative actions spurs us to develop that wisdom rather than just give in to the attachment or the other afflictions. Any questions about that part? Yeah.
I just had a comment when you were saying that. I remember about 10 years ago, Lama Dzogchen made up all these bumper stickers with two phrases on it. The first phrase said, for happiness, cherish others. And the second phrase said, for freedom, abandon desire. So people were taking scissors and cutting off the part that said, for freedom, abandon desire. Like they were fine with cherishing others, but nobody was interested in abandoning desire. It was so terrible.
Wow.
And you could always, like, cut off, you know, bumper stickers because they weren't interested at all in abandoning desire. It was pretty funny.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the big difference between lay life and monastic life. You know, when you were talking about the invisible line, it's actually not so invisible. It's very clear. It's like what you're going to do with desire and attachment and clinging. You know, I think that's one of the big lines there. And it doesn't mean as a monastic you have to be perfect right away, but it's a firm determination to start to deal with that. Yeah. And yeah, and you can see when you firmly believe that desire brings happiness. Yeah, cut off the part that says for freedom, you know, let abandon desire. Yeah.
The thing that came up for me as you were talking is dopamine.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, because we have been habituated since beginningless time with desire, okay? And it is addictive. I mean, what's the energy behind addiction? It's desire, isn't it? Yeah, craving, escape, seeking happiness, and not knowing what causes happiness. And so it's very much the same mental state. Yeah, it's just that some of our addictions are socially sanctioned and some aren't. Yeah.
I know for myself, a lot of I get hung up with not remembering to apply the antidote, let alone remembering what antidote to apply. I mean, there are certain things that will come up that I have. It's like, well, where do I go look for an antidote for certain things? You know, some things I know what to do,
yeah.
You know, but other things I don't. Like, I'm stuck if I get stuck in that.
Yeah, so the question of what antidote to apply. This is where we come back to hearing, thinking, and meditating. Okay? If you learn teachings, if you listen to teachings, if you think about them, and then if you apply the teachings to your own life, then you have some training in the antidotes before the affliction gets really big. But, you know, if we just listen to the teachings, but we don't think about them personally, in terms of our own life, if we just listen to them like, oh, this is a good subject, and oh, yes, that makes sense, then we very easily forget the antidote because we never knew it. And so the whole trick in listening to the Lama Rinpoche thought training teachings is right at, you know, that time and consistently every time we reflect on them to apply them to our life. Okay? And, I mean, for example, with the meditation on death, you know, we talked about death a couple of days ago. Yeah, and we all go, oh, yes, I'm going to die. Yes, right, fine. Well, not fine, but yeah, you know, it'll happen one day, but not for a few more eons, because that's something that happens to other people, not me. And, you know, did we actually sit and do the death meditation after that? No, we just said, oh, yes, I already know that death exists, you know. Or at the most, you know, because when I was saying, you know, did you contemplate the death of your loved ones? How many did you contemplate the death of your loved ones after I mentioned that? One person did. Two people did. Three, you know? So, you know, you got to sit there and you contemplate the death of your loved ones, not just, you know, for 5 minutes, but, you know, repeatedly, you know, get some familiarity with that. What are you going to do? How are you going to feel? How are you going to cope with things, you know? If we get a phone call today that, you know, your mother, father, sister, brother, child, lover, you know, husband, whatever, you know, drop dead. You know, and with our own mind, you know, how are we going to deal when we get a terminal diagnosis or when the car is about to crash? You know? So to spend, you know, not just like, oh yeah, death is there, and oh, all these people have pain, terminal illnesses, that's really sad, and that's, you know, I want to help them eliminate their suffering, and I have so much compassion for them. No, you know, you have to think me, and what's going on with me, and get in touch with your own experience. Because it's only through, you know, knowing our own experience will we ever be able to benefit anybody else. And plus, you know, only through knowing our own experience and working with it are we ever going to be able to help ourselves. So with all these things, you know, it's really important to spend some time thinking about it in relationship to our own life. Not just, well, point one of the outline, point two of the outline, point three of the outline. Yeah? Okay. So like even precious human rebirth, you know, which is a great antidote to feeling depressed. Yeah, what do you do when you feel down? Meditate on precious human life. Meditate on refuge. Yeah. But then, you know, if you go, oh, precious human life, I haven't been born in the hell realm. Well, yeah, so what? Well, no, you gotta really think about that. You know, think about it. Devise your own hell realm. I was telling somebody the other day that my hell realm wasn't, you know, wasn't burning. My hell realm was somebody continually degrading you by screaming at you, you know, without a let up. Okay? That was like, when I thought of hell, I, you know, how could I survive that one? That one's going to destroy me, you know? Think of that. And like, whoo, that's not happening right now. How fortunate I am. And how, okay, I don't want to ever, I realize that that kind of hell realm is created by my own mind. How am I going to prevent my mind from getting in that kind of space where I feel, you know, that there's, you know, I'm constantly getting screamed at? Well, number one, watch how I speak about to other people. Watch what my verbal karma is, you know? Duh. you know? And second of all, you know, watch how my mind fabricates enemies and how I, you know, fabricate fear and, you know, fabricate suspicion and, you know, look how I do that. And if I can see how I can do that, then I can maybe stop myself from creating a hell realm. Okay? So what I'm getting at, the whole trick is you've got to make it really personal. Yeah, this is not theory. And, you know, since we've been talking about the Sangata Sutra, I've been reading Venerable Dhamcha's thesis about it, which is very well done. She did a great job. And she's talking about that this is kind of what the whole thesis is about, is trying to get us to see ourselves as characters in our own autobiography And to realize that what we're experiencing now is the result of our previous actions. And what we're doing now is the cause of what we're going to experience in the future. And so that's why there's so many of these little anecdotes in the sutra, you know, about people who are lamenting past actions, you know, or who are fearful of what's going to happen to them in the future, and how the Buddha is trying to get all these people to see that, you know, who they aren't the same person in the past who did that action and who's experiencing the result in the present. And they aren't the same person in the present as they're going to be in the future who experiences the result of their present action. But there is a relationship there. You know, they're not the same person. So you can look back and have compassion. You can look forward and have love. And, you know, but learning, you know, trying to guide us to be able to see what we're doing in terms of past, present, and future so that we can make wise decisions and understand our experiences correctly. Okay? So the whole point of the Sangatha Sutra is, you know, although they're talking about the young ones and the old ones and, you know, all these kind of stories that seem a little bit incomprehensible to us, if we just stop and look at the storyline itself, it's very often, you know, trying to help somebody navigate that whole thing of seeing the relationship between their actions and their experiences. And so drawing in us as external viewers of this whole thing to start asking that same question of ourselves. Yeah. Okay. And so the whole point of the sutra is they're trying to get us to apply it to ourselves. Yeah. It's just not somebody else lamenting at the time of death because of their negative actions. It's like, what am I going to be when I'm dying? Looking back at what I'm doing now. And if I can imagine how being on my deathbed, looking back at, on what I'm doing now, how do I want to change what I'm doing now? Because what I'm doing now is going to create how I look back on it in the future. You getting what I'm saying?
Yes, you reminded me of asking us about our experience here.
Yes, that was the kind of the basis of the question that I asked some of you when we were discussing last night. You know, I said it in terms of 10 years from now, and then people didn't get it, so I said at the time you die. How do you want to look back at the time that we're spending together in this program? Yeah? What? Because we're co-creating this program. It's not like, you know, oh, there's the teacher and she's designed the whole thing and, you know, then we just sit back as the audience and say, oh, it was a good program or, oh, it was a rotten program. No, you know, we are co-creating this, you know, experience, the group experience, and we are creating our own experience now of it. So from the viewpoint of later, how do we want to be able to look back on this? Yeah. And sometimes in doing this, you know, to see how we are now and how we look back on something we did 5 years ago. Yeah. And from the perspective that we have now, how do we look at, you know, what went on 5 years ago? And I know for me, I mean, so many times it's like, wow, I was so bent out of shape for what? You know? I was like so full of anger or so full of self-pity or so full of attachment, and there was nothing there that warranted all those emotions. You know, when I really look, it's like, boy, wow, I really went off the deep end. There's nothing there to warrant that. Yeah? And so, or sometimes you might look back and, like, the whole experience is there again, and, you know, you've done bodhisattva, some of you, or you will this winter. You know? And you know, it's, you know, it just comes up. Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody at one time or another during that retreat was sitting in this hall sobbing. You know, at least once, you know, perhaps several times. So, you know, I mean, this is natural. There's nothing wrong with it. So it's like from the present, looking back on what happened in the past and how we looked at our previous actions. And sometimes, if we associate a great deal with who we were in the past, then the present emotion is like very strong, because we still somehow think we're the same person. You know? So whatever we did in the past that was really awful, then, you know, instead of being we can't look back at it as if it were another person and forgive ourselves, because we're so identified with that person we were 5 years ago that we just hate ourselves now, because how could I have done that? Or if there was some painful experience that we experienced when we were a kid or whatever, we're so identified with that person, you know, that five-year-old kid, that we think that the experience is still happening to us now, so the emotion comes up really strong. And so part of what the Buddha is doing in the Sangata Sutta is helping people to see that they aren't exactly who that person that they were in the past. You know, there's a link between that person, but you aren't the same person. So you can look back and you can do some purification and you can forgive yourself and you can let go of the past episode. You know, instead of identifying with I am. Yeah, and then remembering that horrible thing over and over and over again, like we so frequently do, don't we? Yeah. So, yeah. So I think, you know, while we're reading the Sangata Sutra, if we can keep that in mind, that might be helpful to understanding some of those more seemingly incomprehensible parts of it. Yeah. But I mean, even if it seems most of it's incomprehensible, you know it has something to do with karma. Yeah, just from reading it, you know it has something, because, you know, people are somehow linking actions and results, and like, how do you learn to link them in a healthy way? Yeah, because there was the one story of the guy who was going to kill himself. I mean, he saw what he had done before, so he was going to go off to the forest and kill himself. And then the gods said, you know, and you know, why was he going to kill himself? Because he thought he was still the person who did those, you know, the five heinous actions before. And then the gods appeared to him and said, no, go seek out this sage. Yeah. You know, and it's like, oh, there's an alternative. Oh, I can do something now that heals the past, and I can do something now that creates a better cause for the future. And so he goes off and seeks that sage, who happened to be the emanation of the Sangata Sutra, which we still don't know what the Sangata Sutra is. Okay. But all of this is, you know, how we work with our mind, and, you know, how this fits into how what I'm telling you now isn't just a general Dharma talk, but is pertaining to monastic life, is that when you're a monastic, you've made a very firm commitment to work with your mind. And the precepts put you in, turn the mirror, so the mirror turns back on us, you know, and when something's coming up and we're wanting to break a precept, it's in our face, and so we have to work with our mind at that time. Okay? So the precepts, you know, kind of they increase the level of mindfulness that we have about things. Mm. And also, another way that becoming a monastic, you know, makes this process more intense is because you can't exit right or exit left, you know, and make yourself invisible. It's like if you're a lay person and there's a lot of attachment. Well, you know, you can follow your attachment, nobody's going to say much because they're all doing it too. If you're a monastic and you go follow your attachment, you know, people are going to go, what's that person doing? Okay? And especially if you're wearing robes, because you've given away all your lay clothes, except maybe one pair of pants that you wear when you're out, you know, emptying the garbage or whatever, you know, then you can't just blend in with the rest of society. And I think this is a lot the thing that people who are lay people, they don't realize. I mean, they realize it at some subconscious level, which is why they don't want to ordain, but I don't think they can realize it at the conscious level, is that you can't make yourself invisible and look like everybody else. you know, which you can when you're a layperson. You know, if you're a layperson and you're angry and you lose your temper and you yell and scream, okay, I mean, it doesn't really look so good. But, you know, everybody's going to say, well, you know, yeah, I do that too, yell, lose my temper and yell and scream and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But when you're a monastic wearing robes and you do that, then, you know, you really stick out. Yeah, and so sometimes that thing, I mean, this is why this cloth is such an incredible protection, because it reminds you, it's like, no, I can't do that. Yeah, and so you know, you can't just blend in with everybody else and act like everybody else. So it really, you know, makes you practice in that way. Yeah. And so, actually, along this regard, how that helps, and again, this was not at all what I had planned to talk about today, but we're getting used to that, aren't we? You know, there's two mental factors, you know, if you study the mental factors. One is what I call integrity. Sometimes it's translated as shame or self-respect. Shame is the most horrible translation. That's another forbidden word at this abbey. Okay. It's a horrible translation of that, and I'll explain why in a moment. And the second one is consideration for others, which is sometimes translated as embarrassment, and that's also a horrible translation. Okay. So let's go back to the first one. Well, first, let's look at the word shame. Okay? What is your connotation of the word shame? Guilt? Bad? What? Regret? Okay. Embarrassment? Or is there any connotation of being inherently flawed? Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the word shame is the way it's used now is kind of when people suffer from shame, it's like they can't show their face. They feel so awful and guilty and terrible about themselves and so flawed and, you know, evil and everything. So clearly that is not a positive mental factor. Okay. So you can see, you know, the common usage of the word shame, you know, that's not a positive mental factor. Shame does have, you know, an old usage of when you felt ashamed of yourself because you knew you could have acted in a different way and you didn't. Okay? That's a different variety of shame. And I think that's why sometimes people translated this mental factor initially as shame, because they were referring to that, you know, when you could have done something better, but you didn't. Okay? Actually, what the meaning of this mental factor is when you choose not to behave in a destructive way, because you care about yourself and you care about your own Dharma practice. So it's self-referential, and there's nothing wrong with being self-referential. This is not at all selfish. Okay? Repeat, this is not at all selfish. Okay? But you abandon doing a negative action because I don't want to accumulate negative karma. Or because I made a commitment to myself to keep these precepts, and I don't want to go against what I've committed to myself. Or because I have a certain sense of my own integrity, and I'm not going to do this because that violates my deepest values of how I want to live my life. Okay? So you can see by that description that mental factor is a very positive one, isn't it? It protects us from harm. It protects us from self-hatred. Because it makes us stop and say, wait a minute, what are my values? And am I acting according to my own values or not? Okay? And so it stops us. So I think I like the term integrity, you know, because I like that word anyway. To me, that's a very powerful word. And because I admire people with integrity, so, and I want to have integrity. So for me, you know, to remember, oh, okay, what's my integrity in this situation is very powerful. Okay? And it really prevents you from doing negative actions, like breaking your precepts. Okay? Then the second one that is also very powerful is this one that's consideration for others. Yeah? Now, this does not mean people pleasing. Repeat! And this is very important. It does not mean people pleasing. Okay? What it means is you're about to do a negative action, and then you think of the effect of that negative action will have on other people. And it, you know, it's not just if I do this action, their feelings are going to be hurt, or if I do this action, it's going to, you know, harm them physically. But it's if I do this action, they're going to lose faith in the Dharma because they see me as a symbol of Dharma practice. Or if I do this, they're going to lose faith in me and my integrity. Okay? So you restrain yourself from doing a negative action because you don't want it to have this adverse effect on somebody else who is going to, you know, have their feelings hurt or lose their faith or, you know, just be devastated by having us act in this way. Okay? So it's consideration for the effect of our actions on others. Okay? How does it differ from people pleasing? Because consideration for others cares about the effect of our actions on others. People pleasing doesn't really care about the effect of our actions on others. People pleasing cares about what others think about us. And, you know, I want this person to like me. I don't really care whether they're happy or not. I don't really care whether they lose faith. I don't care whether they're miserable, as long as they like me. So I've got to do whatever I need to do so that they like me and think well of me. So people-pleasing is totally self-oriented. So I find it very interesting when people say that people who are people-pleasers don't have a sense of self. Because actually, I think they have a sense of self. You know, it's a sense of self where they are so, they lack the ability to evaluate their own actions so that they're seeking their identity from other people, and so you have to please other people so that they think nice of you, so that you think nice of yourself. Okay? So they lack the ability to evaluate their own actions, but they definitely have a sense of self because that self-centeredness is at the self, is at the core of the whole thing. You know? Because I look at my mind when I'm doing something out of pressure because I think I have to, or when I'm doing it because I want somebody to like me, and I don't really care about them. I care about me. You know? And this thing came up, a few people were saying it, I really resonated with it, when I was saying, like, what qualities do we look for in a friend? And, well, they like me. And I really resonated with it. I mean, I'm a total sucker, you know. If somebody likes me, they're my friend, I think they're great. You know, my discriminating wisdom goes totally out the door, you know, because all I want is for somebody to like me. You know, and I will do anything I have to do to get somebody to like me. And I don't care who they are, what their values are, whether they're a good influence for me or not. If they like me, they are great. You know? And so sometimes when you realize this, it's a little bit shocking. Yeah? And it makes, you know, kind of, I mean, I remember realizing that meditation, like, boy, I have absolutely no discriminating wisdom. You know, no ability to evaluate myself. If somebody tells me they love me, I fall over. You know, I'm there. It's so ridiculous. And, you know, see, okay, got to back up here, learn to evaluate my own actions, you know, come back to my integrity and my actual consideration for others, and not just, you know, try and please people so that they'll think I'm nice. Okay, so those are two of the important mental factors that are really important for keeping precepts. Now, if you don't have those two mental factors, it can be very, very difficult to keep precepts. There's a third mental factor that's called conscientiousness. And this is also a positive one, because conscientiousness values what is wholesome. Yeah? And so it has this kind of respect and esteem for what is wholesome or skillful or virtuous or constructive, however you want to translate it. Okay, the mind that is not conscientious, the opposite of that is recklessness. Okay? And the reckless mind doesn't care beans about what's virtuous. Okay? And so, of course, if we don't have any esteem for what constructive action is, what wholesome action is, then we're not going to make any attempt to do any of it, are we? And thus we're going to be very reckless in our behavior, just following any kind of impulse that comes in our mind. Okay? So this whole thing, this brings me to another topic that I wasn't going to talk about, but it's a good one. especially people from my generation. Because my generation really was like, let's let go of inhibitions. Wasn't it? You know, we gotta let go of inhibition. Inhibitions are bad. And still nowadays, you know, my generation passed it on to the younger generation. We did a very good job of, you know, giving them all of our neuroses. you know, just kind of, you gotta be spontaneous and, you know, don't feel guilty about what you do. Just, you know, taking Joseph Campbell's thing of go for your bliss and completely misinterpreting it. And, you know, if it feels good, do it. And so get rid of your inhibitions and do what makes you feel good and just go for it. Okay? And so this has been, you know, kind of American philosophy, hasn't it? And I think we've really misunderstood some things or confused some mental factors that have some similarities. Sometimes they talk about mental factors and their near enemy. Okay? So things that look similar, like consideration for others and people pleasing. Okay? People pleasing is a near enemy of consideration for others, because there's a certain way in which you could really confuse them. Okay? Or maybe, you know, guilt could be a near enemy of integrity, you know, because instead of, you know, like you guilt trip yourself, instead of feeling my integrity, you know, and so I'm not going to do it, you go, oh, my integrity, I blew it, I'm so awful, you know. Or actually guilt, maybe what's better, guilt is the near enemy of regret. That's probably even better, because those are the two we really get confused, okay? So this thing about, you know, let go of inhibitions and act spontaneously, I mean, we can really, you know, and we find this in Dharma teachings, you know? We can so easily misunderstand that kind of language, because what it's getting at is all the namtok, the preconceptions, the superstitious thoughts, the neurotic thoughts, you know, the afflictions, the disturbing emotions, those are what are called the inhibitions, you know. Okay, so that's what we're trying to let go of, because we, you know, I mean, we do such incredible trips, don't we? Yeah, it's like, oh, I can't have that piece of pizza because I'm going to overwhelm my attachment. You know, and so I'm not going to eat all day. You know, you know, we go to this incredible extreme, and, you know, okay, so that kind of thought could be what we call an inhibition. So clearly releasing that's going to be healthy. Okay. But then what we do is we misinterpret it and we think, oh, well, I have inhibitions about, you know, free sex and sleeping with this, you know, somebody outside of my relationship, or I, you know, inhibitions about sleeping with this person and this person and that one. So, oh, I better get rid of my inhibitions and just go ahead and sleep with them all and stop being having so many sexual hang-ups. You know, that's rubbish. Yeah? Okay? So, you know, that's a reckless mind, isn't it? And if that's the mind that's under, you know, use the language of, you know, release inhibitions and be spontaneous, and has completely misunderstood that and made it become a reckless mind instead of a mind that is clear because of wisdom. Okay? Are you getting what I mean about this whole thing of near enemies and how we misunderstand language and misapply things? Okay? And then we get very tangled up because, you know, we seemingly have this philosophy that's supporting our behavior, but it's the wrong philosophy. And then we don't feel good about it inside, and, you know, we just get really messed up. Okay? So, anyway, you know, that the mind that is conscientious values what's wholesome. And then the opposite is the mind that's reckless, which just doesn't care beans. And that's the mind that says, oh, inhibitions, throw them out the window. You know, actually, you know, it depends what you mean by inhibitions. If you mean neuroses, sure, get rid of neuroses. But if you mean inhibitions in terms of, you know, not doing certain things because they're damaging, then, yeah, those kind of inhibitions can, you know, hold the fabric of society together, you know, so that we don't just follow any kind of thought that comes in our mind. Or the whole thing about be spontaneous. We often misinterpret. Be spontaneous. Whatever impulse comes in my mind, you know, act it out. And this is my generation, you know, and people, you know, all over the place. You know, you drink this, you smoke that, you're loaded on this, you're sleeping with that one. I mean, it is just crazy, you know, because it's like be spontaneous. And it's like that's not the meaning of, the real meaning of spontaneous. Yeah. Geshe Zofa's first name, Lindrup, it means spontaneous. That's not what Geshe Zofa stands for, is that kind of behavior. Yeah. Okay. Suppose spontaneous is referring much more to a mind that is unencumbered by ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay? Because you can see ignorance, anger, and attachment bind the mind. They close the mind. They make the mind tight. You know, we can even see sometimes in ourselves there's a spontaneous feeling of love and we squash it, or a spontaneous feeling of wanting to help somebody and then we say, no, I can't. Okay? So that is that kind of thing. That those are the inhibitions that we want to let go of so that we can be spontaneous, so that when there is the impulsive wish to help somebody, we actually do it. Yeah? I've watched my mind sometimes on that one and, you know, just kind of, the mind will, you know, there will be this moment of like, oh, let's go help that person. And then another part goes, oh no, you can't do that. You know, because they'll think strange of you, or they'll do this, or it's inappropriate because of this reason, or because of that, or blah, blah, blah. And then I'll hold myself back. You know, and then at the same time I'm doing that, I'm going, Chitrin, are you absolutely nuts? You know, this is something you should do. And so I've learned, you know, sometimes it's good. Just trust that immediate feeling of wanting to help. Okay. Of course, sometimes we're a little bit Mickey Mouse in the way we want to help too. You know, Mickey Mouse bodhisattvas and that kind of spontaneous wish to help, we have to restrain, because it isn't, you know, somebody's drunk and they're coming to you and, oh, please give me some money, and you give them money. No, that's not smart. That's not compassion. Okay? So there's lots of these kinds of things with near enemies where we really need to look, you know, in terms of our mind and what really is our motivation, what really is going on. And then, you know, in terms of how these things, you know, get acted out in our behavior as well. Okay, any questions about this? Yeah.
In terms of language,
So you, like you're walking by and there's trash on the ground,
yeah.
And you just have the spontaneous feeling, I want to pick it up,
yeah.
As if that you don't have control over that.
Is it
you're intellectually saying I should pick it up?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's that intellectually saying I should pick it up. That's not a spontaneous wish to pick it up.
But it comes from, I know discriminating living, I know this is being lazy, not taking any feedback.
Yeah, but no, that's all intellectual. You know, because it's like, oh yeah, there's trash on the ground, and if I were a good Buddhist who really wanted to get enlightened, mm-hmm. I would pick up that piece of trash.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of lazy, and I don't really feel like picking it up. And so that means I'm a bad Buddhist, and I'm never going to get anywhere in my practice. And if everybody knew what was going on in my mind, how lazy I am about picking up this piece of trash, then they would know that I'm just totally defiled. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know.
Have you felt that way? I felt that way. Have you felt that way?
Like in a series of like.
No, where I get lost is when you say, I don't know. Because when you don't know, then I can't know. Try it again. Try it again.
I'll look at it more.
Okay. Or does anybody else have a better understanding?
I can do a little more. I'm just getting to a
point. This is shooting yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, because we can understand the Dharma intellectually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we say, I should do this. And I should do this, and I should do this, and I should do this, and I should do, and I should do this, and then, you know? I think, for me, it comes in the thing of, I want to do everything right, and I want to do it right so badly. I don't want to make any mistake. I want to do everything right. And, it took me a while to learn that I'm not going to do everything right, and it's okay not to do everything right. And a lot of things I'm not going to know if I did it right or wrong until 5 years from now, because there's no clarity in my mind at this moment. Yeah? And so somehow just, you know, just relax.
Stop learning for a little while.
Just relax. You know? I think sometimes we get so much this like internal policeman looking over our shoulders that we drive ourselves nuts, you know? And a little bit of time just, you know, trusting ourselves, being a little bit easy with ourselves, trusting ourselves. And yeah, I'm going to make some mistakes because I'm not totally aware of all my motivations. And even if I were, I don't know all the ramifications of my actions. And anyway, sometimes it's hard to tell what's a mistake and what's not, even 5 years down the line, you know. And so just somehow just being a little easy. Anybody else have? Yeah.
When this whole thing came up, I was just thinking about one of my main practices in retreat has been learning how to forgive myself and trusting that other people will forgive me too, which has really helped this whole thing of like, I'm always screwing up, I'm always doing it, you know, I'm not as perfect as I want to be. It's like, yeah, I'm just accepting and forgiving myself, first of all, because other people forgive me a lot more than I forgive myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it created so much space. In my practice, then there's space to improve. Like, there's space to practice if you got through to have this, like, cement block of your own blame, you know, kind of blocking your progress. It's like all of a sudden it opens up all this space.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think the other piece of all of this is that I think when it comes to the Dharma, sometimes I get really stopped and held up because I want to know the results before I create these cosmic conditions. I'm being conscientious. I'm so paralyzed about fantasy, you know, wanting to know how it's going to turn out before I even get a chance to to do the thing so that I can find out sometime.
I resonate with that.
So then I don't do anything and I feel really disempowered and I feel discouraged very easily.
Yeah. Wanting to know the results before you create the cause. Can it sit quietly?